to a new album now from singer Inara George. She's best known to pop fans as the voice of the indie rock duo The Bird and the Bee. Her new solo record does not sound like indie rock. It's called An Invitation, and it's a collaboration with an arranger who has been in the business for decades, Van Dyke Parks. Tom Vitale has this story of the collaboration.
Inara George and Van Dyke Parks go way back, way back. In fact, Parks was in Baltimore to greet Inara the day she was born in 1974. Parks was a close friend and collaborator of Inara's father, Lowell George, frontman for the 1970s rock band Little Feat.
Down the street I heard such a soft tune.
Lowell George died when Inara was only 5 years old, but Van Dyke Parks stayed close to the family. For George, the 65-year-old Parks is like a wise old uncle.
He knows so much about so many different things, whether it's composers or actresses or inventors or Plato. I mean, just sitting with him for a period of time, you always have a sense that you've come away knowing something more.
The greatest American pianist who ever lived was Louis Moreau Gottschalk. He was born in New Orleans in 1829. He lived for 40 years. The night of June 6, 1857, Gottschalk sailed from Havana to the island of St. Thomas and skirted the north shore of Haiti.
Parks' recorded interests have certainly been diverse. Over the past 40 years, Parks has written, arranged, and played keyboards for everyone from The Birds and the Grateful Dead to Ringo Starr, Judy Collins, Paul Revere and the Raiders, and U2. Parks is perhaps best known for his work in the 1960s with the Beach Boys.
A diamond necklace played the pawn, hand in hand, some drums along.
But it was a movie that ultimately led Inara George to call Van Dyke Parks and ask him to arrange for her.
Inara came to me and she said, I just came out of that movie, La Vie en Rose, with Edith Piaf, and she was standing there and she didn't have to flail at a guitar or even lug it around to sing those songs. She just had an orchestra do it for her. Would you do that for me? And I said, yes, I will.
So Inara George sent Van Dyke Parks a dozen songs she recorded at her home on her computer with just her voice and guitar. And Parks went to work.
Wanna find the bottom of my heart. Wanna be alone until I'm lonely. Wanna lie down. Wanna be still. Modify my will. Wanna be a kite and fly above your house and then drop down into your room.
George says she never realized that Parks was going to write arrangements that would precisely mimic the phrasing on the demo she sent him until she walked into the recording studio.
I was totally blown away because any inflection that I had done before, Van Dyke had sort of hinted to that. And so singing these songs became really simple and really kind of exciting because the orchestra was always sort of telling me what to do or telling me what was coming.
Have you ever seen the ocean? It's so much darker at the bottom. Wanting something that I'm giving, a lot can happen to the living, back to back, but hand to hand.
The 28-piece orchestra on An Invitation includes 17 strings, 5 woodwinds, and a French horn. Van Dyke Parks plays accordion and piano.
I wanted a string section that's big enough to sound small. You can't do that with a trio or a quartet. It's in the face. Remember Eleanor Rigby? Larger string sections, as the great film composer Alfred Newman told me once in a car, smoking his last cigarette, he turned to me and he said, the quietest sound in the world is a philharmonic. I believed him, and I've heard that there's a point at which strings can disappear.
All the words sound so accidental, rise and fall like an old balloon. All my words. And my marble-heavy mind, wasting time.
Inara George says it was refreshing to create music that was, in her words, organic, with acoustic instruments, and without the electronic overdubbing and sweetening she's used to with her group, The Bird and the Bee.
Would you please clap your hands? Pardon me. The music gets moving.
Inara George and Van Dyke Parks are not sure whether their old fans will go for their new music.
I'm sure that I'll alienate some people, but I don't know who the audience is, but I think there are plenty of people that are interested in hearing things that are challenging.
No, it's not the Beach Boys, and no, it isn't the Bird and the Bee. I think that that will be a problem soon forgotten.
Van Dyke Parks and Inara George are talking to concert promoters in Europe and Australia, hoping to perform the songs on an invitation on tour with a full orchestra later this year. For NPR News, I'm Tom Vitale in New York.
All that he left came back to get him.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. You know the old joke, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. But the way to get to Radio City Music Hall, at least for one retired Air Force colonel, turns out to be $118,182.44. All to realize his childhood dream of playing the famous hall's massive Wurlitzer pipe organ. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
Colonel Jack Molman has played big organs all over the country. One of the second largest Wurlitzers is in St. Louis, where he currently lives, and he has played organs in England and Italy and all over the U.S. But playing this organ in Radio City Music Hall was different. And when he first sat down to play it last Thursday,
it was overwhelming. It's like somebody that owned a Cessna little airplane and all of a sudden had to pilot a 747.
Molman grew up in Oak Park, Illinois, and started playing piano when he was 8. At 14, he experienced the theater organ for the first time. The concert organ you hear in churches is different from theater organs that were developed to accompany silent films and that allow you to create a whole orchestra. That's the kind in Radio City. That organ has 4,000 pipes, 2 consoles, and 4 keyboards. The president of the Theater Organ Society International, Gus Franklin, and Nelson Page, also active in the group, wanted to figure out a way to play at Radio City, but it wasn't happening. The idea to use his own money from bonds and savings came to Molman, he says, while shaving.
I got up in the morning, looked in the mirror, and I said, we're going to go for it. These other people I'd talked to said, you're nuts. But I said, let's go for it. We had to phase it down a little bit.
His original idea was to have more organs, drummers, even the Rockettes. The hall seats 6,000 people, and only about a third of the orchestra section was full Saturday evening. Nelson Page, the master of ceremonies, said about 800 tickets were sold for $50 apiece. Rehearsing was difficult. Molman brought 4 other organists. There are 2 consoles, and communicating between the two sometimes meant talking by cell phone or shouting across the hall.
You missed it.
The 2 consoles are about a block apart.
Hey! You missed it.
As the performance neared, outside on the line were many of Molman's friends, including Joanne Gladfelder, who flew in from Springfield, Illinois, and Don Neer, who flew in from Los Angeles.
I was with him the day he sent the money to Radio City Music Hall to rent the hall.
Oh my God. I went right
home and ordered my plane fare.
I think it's going to be fantastic.
When Molman, who was 67, appeared in a white jacket, he had to maneuver himself with some difficulty up and down off a high chair to speak to the audience, cracking jokes with a dry sense of humor.
I'm glad you're all here. We're going to have a great time. I've got other friends of mine who are wonderful organists. They really play better than I do because they've told me.
He introduced a program of Broadway show tunes, patriotic songs, and some unexpected surprises like the Rubber Ducky song from Sesame Street. In the end, he got a standing ovation, and when asked what was next on his list to achieve, he had only this to say.
Go home and go to bed.
Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Now a story that sounds like a musician's nightmare. Stuck in the same theater night after night, playing the same notes over and over for 20 years. But ask the players who've been in the pit for Phantom of the Opera since it opened on Broadway in 1988, and they say it's a dream. Here's independent producer David Shulman.
Sarah Brightman and the other original stars of Phantom of the Opera are long gone. In the orchestra pit, though, things are different. 13 musicians in the orchestra have been on the job since day one. Trumpeter Lowell Hershey and French horn player Peter Wright are original members. They've been down in the pit more than 20 years. They've had their parts memorized for 19 of them.
For me, the thing is, and I think for a lot of us, is like, we don't want these songs running through our heads outside the show. We don't want to like be waking up in the morning and by mistake start singing in the shower, Phantom of the Opera. And I've never had that.
Well, I did. When the show first started, the melodies just were constantly going through my head. And I would wake up in the middle of the night and I would hear some tunes. My son loved the music so much it was playing on the radio every time I went home, and I had to ask him not to play it. But then, after a few weeks, I got to the point where if somebody asked me to sing something from the show, I couldn't even do it. Somehow my brain just repressed it.
I have been playing Phantom of the Opera since opening night, January 26, 1988.
That's Henry Finelli, the harp player. The first time I called his cell phone, he picked up from Fire Island. "Where are you?" I asked. He said, "Sitting on the deck of the beach house the Phantom of the Opera bought me." If you're a musician in New York, you don't expect your work to buy you a beach house. Even the notion of steady work can seem like a fantasy. Henry's in the pit, warming up before performance number 8,490 of Phantom of the Opera. He still gets anxious.
I've always had nightmares of not being able to get to the theater, being stuck somewhere, or there's no harp here, or the harp breaks, or the music falls down. I have those anxiety dreams all the time. People will say, "How do you stand to hear that music night after night?" Well, you know, playing music and listening to music is not exactly the same thing. It's a wonderfully written harp part that requires artistry and phrasing. And there's one little chord that I have. It doesn't make any difference. The audience would never know the difference. But there's one little chord. There are nights where I arpeggiate the chord just exactly right. This is strange, isn't it? Anyway, there are places all through the show where I really am satisfied if I played it the way I really like to play it.
There's Peter Wright again, without his French horn.
There's a couple money licks. You know, like you have the whole show, and basically, if anyone's even going to notice that you're there from the audience perspective because they're so caught up in the show, there's just a couple times when you have, like, major moments.
Ready? Here we go. From the light flat.
Practice makes perfect. But 20 years of practice?
We never clam. We never make mistakes.
It's bound to happen sooner or later. I mean, and the show's run for so long. Every mistake that's possible to make has been made.
9.8, 9.9. The piano player holds up a scorecard for the most impressive errors. A few shows back, Lowell got a perfect score.
What did you do to earn a 10?
I made a loud, short note entrance a bar early.
When no one else was playing.
Well, I think the harp plays a little.
Oh, good.
Things do go wrong in Phantom of the Opera. It's part of the plot. The Phantom causes a one-ton chandelier to crash to the stage, and a stagehand character gets strung up from the rafters dead. The Majestic Theater hasn't been a dangerous workplace for Lowell and Henry and most of the Phantom's pit musicians. Then again, there have been hair emergencies.
There was a moment where the pyrotechnics, was a big flash when the Phantom disappears, and a spark from the explosion went down and landed in the hair of the first, the oboist. And her hair actually was on fire. And they had to quickly, I'm sorry, I'm laughing.
Well, it's
at the
20
time,
years, a few
yeah.
little things are going to go wrong.
She was uninjured, but there was some damage to her hair, which the hair department
took care of.
They took care of. They cut her.
The hair department?
Well, yeah.
Okay.
They cut her hair.
The length of her hair.
They're experts in that field. Adjusted the length. Yes, that's true.
That kind of excitement is rare. Mostly, the show runs like a clock. 8 shows a week, 20 years, the notes never change. The musicians earn $1,500 a week, about $188 a show or $78,000 a year, if you play every performance. Section leaders get a bit more. You have to wonder, for a creative soul, is it a Faustian bargain? Peter Wright says the answer is simple.
It's not what people think. This show has enabled me to play more creatively than I ever could have in my life, simply because it is stability, and we have a 50% rule. We only need to be here 50% of the time every quarter, so anytime I want to take off to do something, I can. I can do brass quintet recitals, I can play in orchestras, all of us can do all this stuff.
They sub with the top orchestras in New York, and when a regular takes the night off, it's work for someone else. For performance 8,490, the Pitt Orchestra included a horn player who's logged about 4,000 shows as a substitute. To reach the pit, the musicians walk a catwalk under the stage and pass through a narrow doorway.
Watch your head.
27 players squeeze into the pit for each show. For when they aren't playing, Lowell and the other musicians carry along books, crosswords, and Sudoku.
Because I've done it for so long, I know in my body when I'm supposed to be playing. When I'm not playing, I read books, I study languages, and then when I pick up the instrument again, it's a little bit like Tourette's, you know? I drop the book and I blat out a few notes on trumpet and then I pick up the book again.
For NPR News, I'm David Shulman.
Traditional rye music from North Africa, mixed with infectious African and Western beats, has turned into a staple of European dance clubs. But Algerian shabi, or people's music, is no longer widely played. On a recent visit to Algiers, NPR's Peter Kenyon had the chance to learn about shabi, which once filled the kasbahs with exotic melodies and stories of love and loss.
As concert venues go, it's not exactly Carnegie Hall. A few dozen folding chairs are set up in a courtyard in front of a modest elevated stage. A half dozen musicians are crowded around a table groaning with platters of food and pitchers of drink. The crowd is mainly older men, and feet are tapping and heads are nodding along with the rolling, gently propulsive beat. Listeners with MTV attention spans may have a hard time with shabi songs, which can go on for the better part of half an hour. But in this crowd of a certain age, the music evokes wry and wistful smiles. This concert came on Algerian Independence Day weekend, and perhaps the older members of the audience were recalling the days of their youth, when shabi music used to pour from the smoke-filled corners of the kasbah. One of the musicians is Halu Abdelhadi. A few days earlier, he had invited me to his office to talk about the music and about the man known as the father of shabi music, his father, Haj Muhammad Alanka. Shabi has been called the blues of the kasbah, and Abdelhadi says while that's not musically accurate, it does convey how the music was embraced by ordinary Algerians.
My father, when he came in the very sensitive period at that time. It was like the rich people got their own music, classical music. But the poorest people didn't have nothing. So he came in between the middle in order to let the people, the poorest, listening to a music that they will, it's coming from them.
This recording of Haj Muhammad Alanka clearly shows the music's debt to the classical music of 15th century Andalusia, and also how it bent those traditions to its own ends of communicating everyday songs of love and money won or lost.
لو نعيد همي للبحر يصير غل لو نعيد محاني الباب من يدوي
The sounds of Moorish Spain came to North Africa in force when Spain expelled Muslims and Sephardic Jews in 1492. In Algeria, it continued to evolve, Muslim and Jewish musicians playing side by side, absorbing various influences. It could have gone in a number of directions, but Anka, already a well-known musician and teacher, created the musical structure that came to define Algerian shabi. Verses of poetry about anything from religion to love to coffee and tea, interspersed with instrumental passages performed on stringed instruments such as the mandol, ancestor of the mandolin, and the tambour and other percussion, the kanun or zither, and several other instruments, sometimes including the piano and violin. These days, shabi has been eclipsed by rai music, rap, and Western pop, but it's still played in a few bars on the weekends and on special occasions such as this open-air Independence Day concert.
اشرب روحي اشرب روحي استغنى من البوشرة اشرب روحي استغنى من البوشرة اشرب روحي اجعل في دارك بابينا بابارا
Hello Abdulhadi is teaching the music to young students these days, when he can pry them off the soccer field. He says he hopes shabi music, which survived a war for independence and a civil war, can pass the test of time and changing tastes. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Algiers.
اشرب روحي اشرب روحي استغنى من البوشرة اشرب روحي استغنى من البوشرة اشرب روحي اجعل في دارك بابينا بابارا اجعل في دارك بابينا بابارا ليك النهار
When Jeffrey Simon Kavitz preaches at his Unitarian Universalist Church, he's often accompanied by music, but it's not the music you would expect. The minister has been a fan of Bruce Springsteen since the beginning of the boss's career. But now Jeffrey Simon Kavitz has managed to combine his theological training with his love of Springsteen's music. His new book is The Gospel, according to Bruce Springsteen. And Jeffrey Simon Kavitz joins us from the studios of WGBH in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome to the program.
Well, good morning, and I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Was there an aha moment when you realized that Springsteen's music offered more than just good rock and roll?
There have been numerous ones over the course of 35 years now, almost. Probably from the first time I heard him, which was at my wife's senior prom. He's always had this amazing ability to be there when I needed a song to get me through a particular milestone in my life.
Let's start with his Born to Run recording, and in particular, the last moments of the last song on the album, and that's Jungle Land. I want to ask you, first of all, what's the spiritual theme in this song, and what about that scream at the end?
That scream is something. I always wonder why I wrote the book and why I don't just tell people go out and listen to Springsteen, because that would probably be enough. The significance of Jungle Land, I think, is that it's really an epic song. In the end, in Jungle Land, the good guys lose. And that scream is like the exhaustion and the pain of just living life in this world sometimes, which really gets us down and which is really painful and exhausting.
What is it about his music, then, that you think lends itself to theological interpretation? I mean, did you end up going through the whole discography and parsing the lyrics?
I do a lot of parsing all the time. And he's easy to parse because he'll throw in a song that just looks like a little love ditty someplace. He'll have a line about redemption or faith, hope, and love, and they'll just happen to be faith, hope, and love together. And you know it's not an accident if he puts three of them together like that.
Did you find one theme that appears over and over again in his music?
I think there are several. I think hope is never far from the surface in his music, and it's not a pie-in-the-sky Pollyanna kind of easy optimism hope. He presents life as it is, life in all its grit and all its pain and all its complication and dirtiness, really. But despair is never given the last word. There's always hope at the end of the song.
But given the theme of celebrating life, hope for the future, do you think
absolutely
Promised Land from his album Darkness on the Edge of Town would be a good example of that?
Promised Land's a wonderful idea. It's just it could be an any man kind of song. Another thing I think Springsteen does is he reminds us that we all have stories. All of us in the course of our lives in this world live an epic. We live the full five acts. I think Springsteen just helps us to be better people.
In your book, you write about how Springsteen's music creates community, similar in the way that religion creates community. What do you mean by that?
There's a wonderful Springsteen community. It's like any family or like any religion. Any church doesn't always get along with one another, and people don't always agree with one another. His music is a bond for many of us. And I mean, going to a Springsteen concert is more like going to church than any church really is, because it enlivens the whole body and the whole soul, as well as just having somebody like talk at you all the time and whatever happens in church.
I want to play an excerpt from one song that appears on his recording, The Rising. It's called Mary's Place. Let it rain, 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 let it rain. Meet me at Mary's Place. We're gonna have a party. That's probably the most rockin' song on the album, The Rising.
On The Rising.
Yeah, yes. And I have to admit, when I heard it, because sometimes I would hear religious references in some of his songs, I thought that perhaps Mary's Place was a metaphor for heaven.
That's a wonderful possibility, certainly. I see it as a metaphor for the church or the community of faith, you know, with the furniture out on the front porch and the shout from the crowd. But I spend a lot of time in churches, which could be why that I saw church imagery there.
The Rising was released after the tragedies of September 11th. And the title tune, The Rising, you refer to it as an Easter song. So can I assume the theme here is resurrection?
When I've heard Springsteen sing The Rising more recently, it has started to sound more and more like a song of insurrection rather than a song of resurrection.
The story that's being told is a firefighter, and he's praying as he stands before his own judgment. And after that, there's like a chorus. You write it out as Lee, Lee, Lees.
The lies that come out, I think, in The Rising is that song of life, that alleluia in the face of even this terrible... If we can picture somebody going into the World Trade Center and just, you know, knowing he's going to die when he sees the havoc that's there and all the terror and the fire and the blood and all that, must have been just awful scene. Yet in spite of that, what he hears at that point then is the lie, lie, lies. He hears the alleluias of a life that never ends.
I want to just move to his most recent recording, Magic. Mm-hmm. And this is the tune that begins the album. I was trying to find my way. Radio Nowhere.
That's right.
What's the message here?
He wants real life burgeoning forth. He wants just a genuine kind of explosion of creativity, a genuine explosion of music.
You're not preaching this summer. You'll resume in the fall. But are there boss tunes you plan to use in your sermons in the future?
I do a lot of Springsteen in my sermons. I probably do too much Springsteen in my sermons. And I've said it before numerous times. I think my congregation, my little congregation in Stoughton, Massachusetts, is overjoyed that I wrote this book because I have other people to talk to now about this particular subject because they've sort of gotten Springsteened out over the last 15 years. I'll wait till a new album comes out, and then we'll deal with it then, and they'll have something to look forward to.
Jeffrey Simon-Kavitz is a Unitarian Universalist minister. His new book is called The Gospel According to Bruce Springsteen, Rock and Redemption from Asbury Park to Magic. He joined us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I've enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
Is there